Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels, playoff episode number 19. Yes, 19. We're closing in on number 20. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, Britt Giroli here with you talking about game two of this World Series. It was the dreaded bullpen game for the Dodgers, and it didn't go all that well, but it kind of fell apart at a point where I didn't expect it to fall apart, guys. Dustin May allowed a lot of hard contact, only got four outs, only threw 25 pitches. We knew their path was going to be unusual. It was a reasonably early hook for Tony Gonsolin, but he just pitched a few days ago in, I think it was game seven of the NLCS. So there was going to be a limitation there. I kind of felt like they were bouncing between their A guys and their B guys, trying to use the A guys at the top of the Rays lineup, trying to sneak the B guys in against the bottom of the lineup, just based on the way that team's built. And hey, this was one that the Rays had to win, but they did what they had to do and got the job done. So I think this is as much a tip of a cap to the Rays as it is the Dodgers screwed something up.
Yeah, I mean, Gonsolin was used for a puzzlingly short amount of time, especially now that you look back, because May just was all over the center of the plate. It looked like, I was looking at the spray chart of where he kind of lived tonight, and he lived where you don't want to live. It's no secret why the Rays had a lot of really hard hit balls and were able to string together some big innings, especially for them. By their standards, the offense has been struggling for much of this postseason. And you saw it in May's reactions. He knew. He was making kind of those faces on the mound afterwards. He knew he didn't have it tonight. And I guess if you're the Dodgers, though, you kind of, I don't want to say conceded this game, but didn't it kind of feel like, all right, this is what we're doing no matter what. Now we're lined up. We've got Buehler game three. Then we have an off day. And then they're probably, you would think they would go with Urias, right, for game four. So they're set up pretty well. So to me, it kind of just seemed like the proverbial emoji shrug from the Dodgers. If they pull it out, it's a big steal. But in a seven-game series, you just can't play every game like a must-win.
Yeah, I mean, but they did by not letting Tony Gonsolin stay in longer. But, you know, what did Tony Gonsolin throw, like 30, 40 pitches in game seven? You know, I don't know how many more pitches they really wanted him out there for. So this was going to be the strategy all along, and it might have worked. You know, Dustin May was leaving his pitches up. I'm looking here. Willie Adames one was above the belt. Randy Arozarena, oh, that's an out. You know, Savant has like blue and green for balls and in play, and it's just like, dude.
It doesn't work when there's two pitches that are too close together. That's the problem.
Also, Eno's wearing blue blockers. I don't know if that factors in.
I didn't think I'm colorblind, but anyway, the Brandon Lau, one was a curveball at the belt. It is funny though, because Kevin Cash said something really weird about Brandon Lau facing Clayton Kershaw, a low who throws some low fastballs, and thinking that would get him right as a low ball hitter. I did see that he only had one swing above the strike zone, Brandon Lau did, in the Kershaw game. And that has been a problem for Lau. I looked at a heat map for his swings and misses, and there's been a lot way above the strike zone. So he's been really flailing at pitches above the strike zone. And this one, the pitches that he did hit didn't look like they were, you know, super low, but they were belt high, and he didn't swing under a lot of stuff over the top of the zone, and he was on fire. I mean, he hit a homer off of Gonsolin, he hit a homer off of May, really put the Tampa in the driver's seat. And, you know, so far they've only had three hitters with an above average OPS in that lineup. You've got Randy Rosarena, of course. And then you got platoon lefty G-Man Choi, and then surprising power Manny Margot, who's like kind of was supposed to be a platoon guy too. Like, those two guys could fall below average pretty quickly, and then you'd only have Randy Rosarena. So if Lau gets back in there, maybe they don't. There's not as much pressure on Meadows and Yandy Diaz and some of the other guys that have been underperforming. So this could be one of those things where the Dodgers did kind of want to, you know, kind of thought they might lose this game, but the way they lost it may not be exciting to them because they don't want an awakened Brandon Lau. That changes the Rays lineup, I think.
Everybody in the Rays lineup who started had a hard hit ball in this game, so it's nice to see this offense kind of waking up all over the place, because we talked about their dependence on a Rosarena being a major issue coming into the series. At the very least, if you get Lau going, it's still kind of a top-heavy sort of group. So if you're getting hard-hit balls from Wendell and Adames, Kiermaier and Zunino, things are going really well. Now, Blake Snell was pitching great, and things started to unravel on him in the fifth inning. He didn't complete five. I thought he was out after five, even if he was pitching really well, and he was carrying a no-hitter a few innings into this start, and I thought, oh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's a path for him to go a little deeper. But it unraveled on him in the fifth inning, coming up to that third time through the order. Just prior to that, actually, it was the bottom of the order that got him. It was Chris Taylor who hit that home run off of him. There was a sequence in the prior at-bat against Kike Hernandez. I thought he was getting squeezed a little bit, and that made the situation a bit worse. But the thing I liked about Blake Snell, even though he walked four, got to the nine strikeouts, that's outstanding. The slider changeup mix that we were talking about earlier, you mentioned this, you know, he was getting a lot of weak contact with the changeup previously, and he was probably throwing it too much. He got back to using that slider really effectively, and that seemed to really unlock everything else for him.
Yeah, 9 whiffs on 13 swings for that slider. And there was a game where he threw the changeup 30 times in this postseason, and today he threw it 14 times. It wasn't great, didn't get any whiffs, but the one time it was put into play, 52 mile an hour exit velocity. So, like, that's what he should use the changeup for when he's forced to go in the zone and he wants it to be, you know, weak contact. And so he just used it to change things up. And mostly it was the two breaking balls that were so excellent for him. Both had combined a better than 40% called strikes and whiffs. And I thought he pitched well. You know, generally he doesn't have that great command. So I think that's why it's hard to ask him to go very much further than he did.
Yeah, I mean, we talked yesterday about getting him through five, how that would be ideal. Didn't quite get there, but got close enough. And I agree with you, Derek. He was definitely squeezed. I think that contributed to falling behind. He's a guy who I think would rather walk someone than get beat most of the time. And so I think that probably contributed to a little bit more walks than you would think. It just shows, too, on the flip side with the Dodgers, like how quickly they can get back into a game. Like, they punish mistakes. They had no hits, and then all of a sudden they had two runs. Mm-hmm. So you really, to me, the story of the night is the Rays offense kind of getting back on track, just because you're going to have to if you're going to have a chance of beating the Dodgers at all. The Rays, during the regular season and the playoffs, are the best team in baseball when they're leading. They're 32-7, which is pretty impressive. So if Tampa Bay is able to get out to any kind of a lead, whether it's 1-0, 2-0, whatever, they've historically had a lot of success this season because of their ability to, you know, the bullpen and things that we've talked about. But they got a hit. And I think I think that's got to be the theme for tonight.
Yeah, because, you know, the pen pitched really well tonight, and he still gave up two runs. Like you said, like, the Dodgers are going to do it, you know? Like, the Nick Anderson, in fact, his fastball velocity was back up off of the worst of his career. He doubled his whiffs on fastballs, so, like, there was Nick Anderson looked a little better. He got two strikeouts. Yes. He looked a little better. It wasn't quite vintage Anderson, but he looked better. And he still gave up a homer. And Pete Fairbanks was pretty close to vintage Pete Fairbanks. I mean, he was throwing hundreds up there, and maybe the command wasn't great. He gave up a homer. So, like, this is about what you can expect from the pen. If they're going to have to go four innings in a game, then they're going to give up a run or two. So you can't just expect to win 1-0. But I thought there would be this would be an interesting side question to ask you guys. Snell went 4 2/3, gave up two runs. The team was leading when he left. Nick Anderson got four outs, gave up a run. Pete Fairbanks went 5 outs and gave up a run. Loop went got 3 outs, no runs. And Diego Castillo got 1 out. Who gets the win?
I know the correct answer because I know who was given the win. What should happen?
Who should get the win?
In this situation, what should happen is we should look at something like win probability added. And if that's really close, then
Loop,
it should go to Snell. Snell did more than any one of the other pitchers that contributed toward this win. That is...
He did.
I feel like this is an SAT-type question, and you could just argue it a million different ways.
Britt was right.
It's Loop.
If you look at win probability added, it was Loop.
That's what I would have said, because if you look at the situation, Loop came in. The Dodgers were threatening, and I think that's when I said, hey, Eno, you better start writing, because you were going to write a story if the Rays lost.
And he got a bunch of tough lefties out.
Yeah, the tides, it seemed like they were a turn in there for a second. And Luke came in with all his funky stuff and was able to shut it down. He got real lucky on that ball that was scorched down to Wendell, I believe.
Yeah. I just don't think that maybe win probability is the exact right thing, because the win probability goes up as there's fewer outs, right? So you're gonna give it to people that pitch later in the game, even for no good reason. Almost, I think you have to consider bulk a little bit. I mean, Snell got 14 outs. You know, the closest anybody got was 5.
Right. He got more than half. Like, you need 27 to win. He got more than half. That should be enough.
I'm giving him the win. I know win probability says Loop. I would get, like, yes. I think holds, I know holds aren't great, but I think holds are interesting for arbitration, for, you know, just to award people something for doing something good.
Yeah. What Loop did, not sexy, though.
But I like Loop. I think Loop got a hold, you know, a big hold.
A hold that we would care about ordinarily, not the hold like you showed up, you faced a guy and left the game, like not the pre-3-batter minimum, faced one guy and left, came on, walked the guy and left.
Secondary save?
Yeah.
A half save.
A meaningful inning, a meaningful high leverage inning. Oh, that'd be just a brutal acronym. Like we can't start down that path.
So when I was covering the Orioles, Buck used to call, when guys made it out, but it was like a good out, he used to call them POFOs, productive outs for the Orioles.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
And he'd be like, so-and-so had 2 POFOs. Mm. And other visiting writers would be like, what the hell is this guy talking about?
Also rolls right off the tongue. It sounds a lot like a mofo, but...
Totally. I guess we can come up with some kind of acronym, productive inning for the Rays.
Yeah.
Basically, could have given the win to anybody but Nick Anderson, and I would have said, good choice.
How about multiple out flame outing? Mofo. Luke gets the mofo.
But the problem is the flames mofo are hard hit balls in our world now. So those work against pitchers. So,
dude,
it's like goat. Used to be a bad thing, and now it's the greatest of all time. That's remember right. when we goats were bad? Up.
But the dude, speaking of those fire things, man, Dustin May got 4 outs, faced 8 batters, and had 6 hard hits.
That's not good. There's not a... I don't look at that all the time, but I do look at it frequently, and I can't recall seeing a 1 1/3 from a reliever with 6 hard hit balls next to it.
It really stands out.
I wouldn't expect to see it from Dustin May. Like, it's another outing where you're like, the stuff is good, but the command isn't. And something else could be wrong there too. I don't know if it's that he tips pitches sometimes or if it's sequencing or what exactly it is, but somehow the sum of the parts is worse than it should be. And it drives me crazy watching him because he's fun to watch, but then he disappoints you and he becomes an unfun watch as a result.
That's true. That's true. I mean, here's my issue. And, you know, you like him a lot. Why is Gonsolin kind of treated as like their, like, schlep? Like, he's a legitimate arm, is he not? He's got three pitches. I know he's been used a bunch, but it just seems like he's kind of like, oh, we're just going to go with him. He's the mop-up guy. He's whatever. I don't know. Why don't the Dodgers value him?
I mean, he's given up some hard contact. Maybe he's like too north-south. I mean, if you look at these Dodgers, they seem to care about horizontal movement, right? Like they care about suppressing home runs. I think even though Dustin May, I mean, he did give up a homer, but you know, usually you'd think a guy like Dustin May or Bruzdal Gaderol with the velocity and with the horizontal movement would suppress some home runs, get off the barrel a little bit. And I think Gonsolin doesn't do that. He has almost absolutely no wiggle side to side. He's almost completely a north-south guy. So maybe they think he can do well when it comes to strikeouts and walks, but give up homers. And that's been the story of his postseason. So I still like Gonsolin, but maybe that's it. I don't know.
Right. Gratterall doesn't miss many bats either, though. Isn't that the issue of putting him as a potential closer right now, is that he doesn't get enough swings and misses?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of all messed up by this Dodgers squad. Like, you know, I can't
what
tell.
Are they doing?
No, but I can't tell if they're ahead of the pack or behind or you know, outsmarted themselves, because, you know, this is one. I think this year or last year was the first year that results on the four seam and the two seam converged. One of the reasons we started throwing a lot more four seams is the four seams were better, you know. That was why we started throwing the high four seam and people started going to the four seam more and using it for whiffs and all that stuff. But then, you know, fewer and fewer people that had bad sinkers were throwing the bad sinkers anymore. So you kind of whittled it down to only the good sinkers, and all of a sudden they converged. If you look at sort of wOBA allowed. So I think maybe the Dodgers like outsmarted themselves and they're like, hey, you know what? Like two seamers are good again, or you know, like we can be out in front of people by getting the three best two seamers in baseball. Or if it's just like, you know, the personnel they ended up with, and it's not really working out. Like Dustin May, Bruzdal Gaderol has been good, but like, you know, Blake Treinen can get hittable too. I mean, Dustin May tonight, the sinker got hit. I don't know if it's the command or if it's the sinker. The sinker does not get great results, despite him throwing it 100 miles an hour.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Is Tony Gonsolin the new Stripling on this team? I mean, look at the overall body of work. Like, pull away from game two tonight and just look at what he's done in 86 and two-thirds regular season innings last year and this year. He's pitched to a 260 ERA, a .92 whip, 83 strikeouts in 86 and two-thirds innings. You look at those numbers and say, that's a good starter on most other teams, and he's just more of that glue sort of guy for the Dodgers. They had a handful of times where they had to use him like a regular starter during the season. That went fine. But when the chips are all on the table, it seems like they do kind of have that reservation that they had for a long time with Stripling. And there would always be these instances where Stripling would get those chances, and usually he would exceed most people's expectations, but then they'd bump him back. Beginning of this season, they preferred Alex Wood to Ross Stripling. That was weird, right? And now Alex Wood was the guy that pitched today when they were trailing. And I thought, we had a question that came in on Twitter. I think it was from Alex, and it was about Urias and whether or not he was really in the mix for tonight. And I think the way I saw it maybe happening was if the Dodgers were protecting a lead sometime in the middle of the game, around the fifth inning or so, and they needed that bridge, they needed 7, 8, maybe 9 outs if he's really efficient, Urias was that guy, and you'd say, don't worry about game four right now. Let's win game two. And then Alex Wood, who came in because you were losing, he probably becomes your opener or your guy that goes to the lineup the first time in game four. You punt later, right? You go up 2-0 if you can, and you say, well, we'll deal with game four later because we're going to have the off day. We're going to see how game three goes, and we got, you know, Walker Buehler going in game three, so hopefully we're not even that taxed coming out of the pen going into game four. Like, I think that was the way they were going to use Urias. I think that was really the only way we were going to see him in game two.
Yeah, and Dave Roberts tonight again did not rule out getting Woods to start at some point in this series. I think it'll probably be an opener situation, like you said. Side note, guys, I do want to give Blake Snell his due here. This is a great stat by Stats. Pitchers with 8 or more strikeouts and no hits allowed through 4 innings of a World Series. Blake Snell tonight, and Sandy Koufax in the 1963 Game 1. I have a feeling that Sandy Koufax probably recorded more than 2 outs after that fourth inning.
Fair bet.
But still, a nice stat. Also, it does seem like Eno said yesterday, the stats are getting a little out of control with the this plus this plus this.
Also, a lot of like cumulative stats where you're like, yeah, dude, we just had the longest postseason of all time, which, let me say, it felt a little bit like that, but that's all right.
It's true. It is true. Well, Randy Arozarena, I think, passed Derek Jeter, right, in postseason hits, which, again, it is the longest postseason of all time. But it is Randy Arozarena, so we should definitely give him his due, because I feel like we talk about him at least once on every show.
You just got to get him in there.
I'm looking at the Koufax playoff game log, and he pitched in 4 different postseasons. And anytime he started a game, he went at least 6. He had 4 complete games, and 2 of them were shutouts. So, yeah, he yeah, he did not, have the, Blake Snell.
A little bit different than getting 10 outs.
People were looking up like, oh, when was the last time we had a non-injured starter go as short as Gonsolin did? And it's like, okay, well, this base, you can't compare. It's like comparing apples to like pine cones, right? It's like a totally different game now. Of course, this is going to be some kind of history. We're all equally befuddled. And you didn't even see this a year or two ago. Like this, like, hey, let's take a...
Yeah, right? It's totally different. Like Jason Stark has this cool bit in his piece tomorrow. Nick Anderson has now pitched in every inning between the 3rd and the 9th. That's awesome. It's cool. It's actually kind of just an explanation of how different baseball is now than it has been before.
Yeah. You know?
He might get the cover all. Cool.
It's slowing the game down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also.
I don't think I've ever complained about pace of play because unlike you guys, I don't cover games at the ballpark. And I've never hosted a post-game show until this year. I notice pace of play a little bit more now. Just a little bit. Because when I watch the game and the game ends and I go to bed, I don't care what time the game ends. But when I have to come in, talk about the game for a little while and put the podcast together, I start to think more about it.
I notice it as a fan, but I notice it differently as a fan. When I'm sitting in the fans' seats, I don't notice necessarily how long I've been there because I'm happy. I'm having a beer. I'm talking to someone. I'm you know, having a hot dog, that sort of deal. Like, I don't notice how long the game is, but I do notice the lack of balls in play and the sort of the lack of pace. Like, I do notice that because, you know, just do one thing when you're, like, sitting at the park and, like look up from your phone for like a whole inning and like watch it and watch the other fans. And you'll notice that they all look up when there's a ball in play, you know? And now that we're at the very nadir of balls in play, like the very fewest balls in play of all time in baseball, that means that people are looking up from their phones at the very least amount. And I think that does mean something. I would do something about velocity. I might think about lowering the mound. I might think about putting a pitch clock on the pitchers, telling the hitters to get in the box. Like I would attack pace of play and the ball in play thing as like kind of a part and parcel. It's something that's something we can change. If we don't like something about the game, we can change it. It doesn't have to. We don't have to like play the same game we played 120 years ago when they said, please, sir, could I have a high strike, please?
Right. That's true. Anywhere they just got the ball and immediately threw it. But yeah. I do think as a fan, even watching the games on my couch, like I was talking to a baseball executive the other day and he said, you know, I was watching the game and I was going to hit pause because I had to pee. But then I'm like, nah, it's fine. I'll rewind it when I get back. He's like, I get back. I haven't missed a single pitch. And he goes, and I really had to pee. So
that's the TMI. But that's true. I actually managed to shower the dogs and the kids and missed only 3 pitches. It was like there was like a pitching change and I did it strategically, but I came back and I was like, whoa, dude, the same guy's up, man. And I was like, I did a good job.
That's what I mean.
I just threw them in there and just sprayed them down. But
yeah, I was wondering if you just hosed them all off.
Yeah, it wasn't like an amazing shower. It was just like
the two dogs, you know, and the two kids all in there at the same time.
Up top, down low, get the milk off the dog. All right, we're good.
If you could have each kid kind of like hold a dog for you, you know, you could streamline the whole process.
Well, the good news is the dogs seem to like it. So
it's good. It's good to have dogs that like to be bathed. It makes that whole process
a lot easier.
So, all right, game 3, game 4, those are going to happen before all of us get to speak again. So, what are we looking for here? We get the off day Thursday, come back Friday, Saturday. Actually, we're going to have 3 games completed before we speak next on Sunday night. So the series could theoretically end Sunday, and we could be talking about a World Series champion. I don't see the series ending that quickly, though. I think these teams do match up well enough where, you know, you're going to find a way for the Rays to get one of these next 3, and they can get more. I just think they've basically got a coin flip. I think Morton versus Buehler is very close to fair. I think they do have the disadvantage in Game 4 now that we expect a fully rested Julio Urias to be going for the Dodgers, probably against Ryan Yarbrough. We'll see what the Rays want to do since Yarbrough pitched a little bit in Game 1. And then in Game 5, we go back to Clayton Kershaw on the Dodgers side going up against Tyler Glasnow again. So that's closer to a coin flip, even though that favors the Dodgers as well. I mean, the more you get a feel for this series, what do you see in this middle section, in the meat of the series?
The possibilities, right? Yeah. Predicting 3 games will make your head explode.
The bullpen depth will matter a little bit. I don't think anybody wants, you know, Pete Fairbanks or Nick Anderson to go 3 straight games of 20 pitches or 30 pitches. So I think that swings a little bit towards the Rays. Have you guys noticed? I don't look at these sort of things, but Charlie Morton is nails in the postseason.
Yes. I remember that from, was it last year?
Yeah, dude. Like his.
It was last year they made a real big deal about it.
Yeah, they did.
So I think they win.
I just don't even listen
game.
To that sort of stuff.
But. Yeah. And it's not just like he's made 2 starts, right? He's got a considerable track record.
Yeah, let me pull it up because I wasn't even gonna quote the numbers because it seems ridiculous. But it was 57 innings now. In 57 innings, he has a 2.84 ERA, a 1.16 whip. And this one I think is sort of great. In the last, as a Ray, they've handed him the ball 5 times in the postseason. He has 5 wins. This is the Rays you're talking about. You know, they could have taken him out, you know, like a Snell situation where they still won the game, but he didn't get the win. Like, he is legitimately, you know, his strikeout rate, some of it is the shape of his career, right? He was a little bit worse early in his career, and the teams are worse, so he didn't go to the postseason. And as he got better, he was on better teams and he went to the postseason. So I am going to look at this. It's funny. I asked the two guys, Buehler and Morton, about stuff in the Zooms today. And I talked to Buehler and I said, you know, the cutters kind of went away when the blisters were happening and you got a bunch of walks, you were throwing a bunch of curves. Is this all the blister? And he's like, he basically said, yeah, like I couldn't throw the cutter. Like that's basically what he said. He said certain pressure on that finger just didn't work with that blister. And so in the last outing, he had the most cutters that he'd thrown and since before the blisters. So you know, I think that Bueller is like ready to go and he's going to be vintage Bueller. But I talked to Morton about, you know, what makes him such a great postseason pitcher. And he was like, well, I think you'd want to, like, there's a decent sample now. And I think you'd want to go and look and see if maybe my pitch mix was different and see if maybe I did things a little differently. See, maybe if my velocity is a little bit better in the postseason, you know? and like, I was like, yes, thank
voice?
You for laying it out for me. I will do that in a piece tomorrow. Thank you for that. So I have looked a little bit and I will look more, but I just want to say, I don't want to jinx him. So I got to be, you know, I don't care. I don't know if I believe in jinxes, but I don't want to like set him up, be like, you know, he's amazing. And these are all the things he does differently. Let me do your advanced scouting for you, LA. Like these are all the amazing things, but that he does differently in the postseason. But what I've seen is he goes to sinker a little bit more. And with added velocity, I think his sinker is more effective. He also surprises people a little bit by going to the sinker more when he's been such a four-seam guy in the regular season. And just a shout out to Morton. If we don't get to talk about him again and he retires or whatever, he is one of the most emotional, you know, with it, with the new wave metrics, but also in touch with himself, piano, like guitar playing. Like, I mean, he's just a joy to cover. I mean, I was just standing next to him while he was just crying tears of joy after the Astros won that game and clinched the World Series, and he got the final outs. And it was just he kept deflecting to other people and talking about how it was great for everybody else and how he was just so happy for everybody. And I just wanted to say, I stand Charlie Morton, man. That guy is great. Whatever he does in Game 5. And so if you're asking me for a pick, Charlie Morton's going to win.
That was a long, winding road to get to that pick.
I relabeled that segment. It was initially games 3-5 predictions. Now it just says Charlie Morton's playoff success in the show notes.
Sorry.
So,
I don't think we have enough time to hear Eno's game 4 and 5 predictions.
I'm always good for one rant a show. That was my rant. End rants.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
There's a chicken and egg thing though with the success that Morton's had with the Rays. He's 5-0 with the Rays in the postseason. He's never completed 6 innings. It's 5-5, 5-5, and 5 2/3, and that was in Game 7 when he was pitching extremely well. Part of the reason he might be this good in the postseason is because he's not getting through the lineup that extra time.
The Kershaw problem.
20-22 batters faced in all of those starts. That's a big deal. You're not pushing him all the way through the order a third time. I think that's a huge part of it. And the 3-5 part of the series is going to be really interesting, because if Morton does that again, the Rays are going to use their A relievers, assuming they have a lead or it's close. If you get to Game 4 and Yarbrough doesn't get very deep into that game, if he's only going to go 3 or 4, you're going to have to try and string it together with some of your B relievers. Otherwise, you run the risk of possibly going 3 in a row, because you're going to want to throw
a loss for me, dude.
A relievers again.
The Yarbrough
game
is a loss for me.
Yeah.
I think I feel the same way. I think we all liked the Rays going into Game 2. I feel the same way about the Dodgers having a clear advantage in Game 4. Like, it's interesting that they each kind of have this problem that they have to deal with. Each team's going to have one punt game, most likely. And if you could steal the punt game, you've done really well.
I do think the Dodgers take 2 of the next 3. For all the reasons you guys discussed, there's a clear advantage there. That Kershaw-Glasnow game is kind of a little bit more of a toss-up. Would I be shocked if the Rays stole that one? No. Would either of you? I think we can make the case that, you know, they could hit Kershaw harder than they did, especially if the lineup continues to kind of find its way a little bit, right?
Or they take Glasnow out earlier.
Yes, and we know the Dodgers make adjustments. So, you know, I don't see Glasnow all of a sudden pitching 6 or 7 innings, but I see Kevin Cash maybe pulling the puppet strings a little bit earlier, going to the bullpen, knowing. I think there's a difference, too, in these long series. When you get to over that hump, you know now you can just ride these guys, right? You're at games 5, 6, 7. Like, this is it. I don't care who you have to use, when and where. And you just can't manage like that in games 1 and 2 if you want your relievers' arms to still be screwed on by the end of the series. So I think we're going to see a very different game when we get to that Kershaw-Glasnow game again. And I really do think this series still goes at least 6. I hope it does.
It could be Dodgers win, Dodgers win. I mean, it really could be. But I'm going to go Rays win, Dodgers win. Oh, man. I don't know.
See, that fit, it's such a toss-up.
If it's a blowout.
That last game?
I think if it's a blowout in game four, I think that actually is good for the Rays because they'll just put Sheriff out there for, you know, three innings or something and save all their bullets.
Fleming, yeah, they'll throw those guys Fleming, out there. Yeah. Just let them chew up a few innings and have everybody ready to go. And if they need to pull a glass now after three, they get them through the lineup one time in game five and then go A relievers. That might be the plan. I think the Rays take game three and they lose game four. I think the Dodgers are going to win five. It's going to be 3-2 Dodgers the next time we speak on this podcast. So the Rays fans are going to be going crazy coming out of game three. They're going to be on that emotional roller coaster. And as the weekend comes to a close, they're going to be facing elimination and panic mode will have set in.
I mean, that's the life of a fan, right?
It's the life of a fan. That's the price of being there, right? You have to run the risk of being hurt very badly if things don't go the way that you want. So I'm on 3-2 Dodgers when we get to our show on Sunday night. Any other thoughts here before we get out?
Enjoy the weekend as much as you can. I mean, enjoy. I think, you know, Rich Hill is like, there's this guy named Baba Ram Dass who's like, be here now. And he says, like, be in the present. And Rich Hill is like my Baba Ram Dass. And I'm sorry he's not in this World Series because he always talks about be present, enjoy the highs and the lows, you know. And so I think even as a fan, try to do it. Try not to chew all your nails off and just try to enjoy this, that this incredible thing is happening.
Take a few breaks from Twitter in the next few days as well. Yeah. So this would be a time for me to say, don't follow us now. Or if you do follow us now, you know, turn the app off for a few days on Twitter. She's at Britt_Giroli. He's at Unoceris. I'm at Derek Van Riper. If you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, you can get one for $1 a month at theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels. Gets you all the great coverage that we have about the World Series and about every other sport that we're covering as well. Big Ten football is back. Yeah, that's right. That came back. Ooh. Thought that was definitely on ice for a season, and they resurrected it. So I'll be sure to read my Big Ten coverage this weekend with that schedule getting underway. Enjoy the next three games of the series. Enjoy some time away this weekend. We are back with you after Game 5.
Thanks for listening.